This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. A sheriff's deputy assigned to a South Carolina high school violently removed a black female student from her seat and arrested her, all captured on a classmate's cell video. The video went viral. It is spurring conversations around the country about the way we police students of color. Race in the classroom is one of many of the topics we'll talk about this month on Culture 360. Joining me in the studio is Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie's an Emmy-nominated producer and filmmaker and a professor of film and media studies at St. Augustine's University. Welcome back, Natalie. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank.
Mark Anthony Neal, a professor of African and African-American studies at Duke, author of the book New Black Man and host of the weekly webcast Left of Black. Mark, welcome back.
Hey, Frank.
Let's talk about this footage of this this disturbing footage. It's not an isolated incident. I think we're hearing some of that these days, like, oh, well, that's clearly an outlier.
I think there's not a black parent or a grandparent in the country right now that doesn't consider the fact that their children are potentially going to be under assault, whether that be via the curriculum, via style of instruction, and in this case, actual violence. I think that's always a consideration. I think it's why so many black parents spend time looking at different kinds of schools, looking at public schools, charter schools, private schools. It's why my parents, you know, 40 years ago sent me to a 7-day Adventist school, you know, for all those kinds of fears of what could happen to your black child when you send them in some of these educational settings. Isolated is a problematic way to look at it because, you know, it traffics in what we know is the, for black folks, the always already known. These things that are part of our everyday experience that the larger society only sees when it shows up on a handheld device. And they're shocked and they're surprised and they're like, well, this can't be a regular occasion, but it is, right? And it's, you know, that's the tip of the iceberg, but it's the everyday assaults. It's the challenges to the intellectual capacity of the kids. It's the lack of expectation for the kids. It's the treating, criminalizing the kids, whether or not they are criminals or not, that goes on a regular basis that the larger society never gets a chance to see.
Well, the presence of uniformed police officers in selected high schools. I mean, this has to be a message that it's taken on board, I would think, internalized by the students of those schools, Natalie.
Well, I would think so, too. I mean, I was in preparing for the show, I was looking at a report from, I believe it's the Center for Problem-Oriented Policing, and it includes information about what SROs or school resource officers are and the prevalence of them when that happened. Like, and basically over the past 25 years, these officers have shown up in class or in schools on a full-time basis as a widespread practice. And, you know, I have questions about why that is. But I think that clearly, if we look at the fact that they're, at least in this instance in South Carolina, you know, we've got one in a high school, and it seems to be a predominantly black high school. You know, the kids are, from what I've read, were afraid of this SRO. They were afraid of this officer. He had a reputation for slamming people, women in particular, it sounds like. And, you know, to the extent that he had been nicknamed Officer Slam. So I wonder why he was still in the school in the first place. Right. But I also think, you know, it definitely speaks to the fact that children of color, black children in particular, are just seen differently. They require, I guess, a different type of right. policing than other children do. And I don't think that this type of presence, this type of law enforcement presence would even be allowed. It would not be tolerated in a predominantly white school, not to this extent.
Our children don't get the chance to be children in school, right? They're already, you know, treated as adults, criminalized as adults, never get the chance to do the small little things, smaller infractions that a seventh grader might do. When it's considered in the context of black and Latino students, is always seen as tantamount to something else, right, that's going to be much more dangerous and has to be contained and incarcerated at some point.
Well, you can imagine the conversations. I don't know how you get to the point where you put a police officer in those schools if it were other schools. I mean, if these were all white school systems, somebody on that PTA would be saying, look, these are children. These are behavioral problems. I understand it can be dangerous, but we have to deal with it. I'm hearing that PTA meeting, and it doesn't happen here.
But think about the places where these mass shootings are occurring, mm-hmm. where they actually probably need to have SROs.
That's right.
And the response in those situations are, well, the teachers need to be armed.
Right. And, you know, there are reports, there are studies that have been done. In fact, a new one was just reported on in Salon a few days ago, I believe, that talk about how police officers see black kids, male and female, as older and less innocent than white kids. So, you know, if you're starting off there,
right.
then you know that when a police officer is present in a school that's predominantly black, the deck is already stacked against our kids. And so it's just a matter of time before this type of thing that we just saw in South Carolina happens, whether with a girl or a boy. Right. And I guess, I, as a mom of both a son and a daughter, I have to say that it is stunning that a man would do the type of violence that this man did, this officer did, against a girl.
Who is seated. I mean, pretty much trapped inside the
desk. I mean, he threw her around as if she were nothing. Right. And I just think that speaks to, that's not just in the schools. This is a pervasive way of looking at black people in this country.
And it says it's not a one-off. I mean, remember the attention this summer in Texas, a police officer unholsters his weapon, arresting a black teenage girl at a pool party. There seems to me a kind of problem in public memory in even stitching them together to remember this as one and not as at least two and many more.
Is it a problem with public memory, or is it just the reality of anti-black racism, right?
Go.
And anti-black violence, right? Where, again, it's like that conversation that in the film A Few Good Men. And he's saying, you know, you want me on this wall. And I think there are folks in America that really believe and are fearful of black bodies in such a way that they will allow any kind of violence to occur to black children in pursuit of somehow containing, black bodies.
For safety's sake.
Right.
What about this? Some of the comments and the commentary we've seen since, the idea that, yeah, he shouldn't have done that. That was outrageous. But these kids got to learn not to mouth off to teacher, but they need to put their phones down. I'm wondering about the conjunction in that sentence where there has been an assault committed by a man against a girl, and then, but they're mouthing off to children.
The conjunction is invalid, period. I mean, there's no legitimacy to equating what the girl was doing in the classroom with her cell phone. She was quiet from all reports. She wasn't disrupting the class. She just wasn't cooperating. But I just want to say on her behalf that, you know, she recently lost her mother and her grandmother. If I were a 16-year-old in a class who's expected to pay attention to something that I can't even relate to right now because I'm grieving my parents, my grandparent, and I am alone in the world.
In foster care.
And in... Right. What do you expect? And the fact that no one seemed to know this, or if the school knew, they didn't do anything about that. What does that say about how this student is even perceived? Where is the love and understanding? And especially with the SRO officer, from what I understand, part of the training is supposed to be in child development and psychology. So where was that? What was going on that he could not pick up on the fact that something is going on with her? Let me talk to her. Right. Let me not throw her.
This gets back to the systemic part, that it's not just a one-off. If you choose to put a police officer who's trained in violence in a school and then add on some training about psychology, you've told me where your preference is systemically. Otherwise, you would put a psychologist in there who is trained at maybe calming down a difficult situation.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right.
So it's systemic. Let's talk about, but then again, Mark, let's talk, switch now to, I think, a related controversy, and this is the Texas textbook controversy that brings into sharp focus the way we tell our story.
And this, I'm actually going to go back to the cell phone on this, right? Because I almost think we need to reinforce to our children to always have access to their handheld devices because of the kind of violence that we saw in South Carolina. So it gets captured. But of course, we know about this story in Texas in the textbook because of a young student who had the wherewithal, you know, to see what he was reading, know that it was problematic, take a picture of it and send it to his mom. Because he knew, right, this camera was a way that he could help tell the story in the way that it needed to tell. You know, so we know this is big business, right? These are textbook companies, right? The state of Texas is a huge, you know, customer for some of these textbook companies, right? To the extent that they get to dictate what's going to be in these books. We're looking now, of course, across this country in terms of state legislatures having their hands in what curriculum looks like, whether or not they actually have expertise in curriculum or not. From the time that I spent teaching at the University of Texas, I was actually stunned at the extent that high school students that are coming out of the state of Texas public schools know very little about American history, right? Let alone specificity of it around, you know, anti-Black racism and slavery and these kinds of things. So the story itself was not surprising.
Well, let me just stop you right there just to get a little bit of context for the story. There are widespread complaints that it really soft pedals that's history and social studies. You know, we're seeing reports of slaves being brought to the American continent
as workers.
Right?
As
and
workers,
so the word slave
right.
is expunged from that. That particular little emigration story.
Right. And the benefit of their coming here is they developed a rich culture and religious tradition.
Right.
Right.
So as though there had to be some balance. So slavery was bad, but hey, fair and balanced.
It's a conjunction.
We got Michael Jackson.
Right.
We got Michael Jackson. Exactly.
All of this, you know, riddled throughout this book. And so it might lead you to think, well, I guess not so bad a deal at all. Right. And so this is the context. Now, this is the story. And these phrases are actually in the textbooks. But go ahead.
Yeah, you know, the thing was surprising is that the textbook company immediately is like, oh, this is a mistake. And it's like when you actually look at the textbook and hear the narratives, right, the great op-ed that was in the New York Times last week about this, you know, talking about the use of passive language in terms of how, you know, whenever they talked about slavery and the ill effects of it, right, it was always in the third person, right? It was never an actual person. But when they talked about how some slaves had a good experience and some slave owners treated them well, then that was always in first and second person, right? So those kind of little subtle things that's not happening accidentally, right? Someone has a formula that shows how do you tell this story and not actually lay blame at the foot of anti-Black racism and white supremacy.
Right.
Or in any way suggest that much of the wealth in this state and those families who are still benefiting by that wealth owe it to unpaid labor still today.
Right. Right.
You can't that obviates any kind of guilt, not even guilt, but any sense of remuneration that might be part of the real story.
Right. So reparations are out of the question because you know, these workers did the work willingly.
Yeah.
And there's so much that they got from that experience. I just, you know, I think that one of the things that this story about this Texas mom, you know, really putting this textbook company on blast says is that as parents, we have to be involved. I mean, we have to pay attention to what our kids are being taught in school. Not only do we have to be vigilant about making sure that they are safe, but we have to make sure that they're not being fed the same sorts of lies that are, you know, running amok in our culture in general. And, you know, I think it's a tall order, but there is a high responsibility that is placed on our shoulders, because if we do not do it, these types of lies are perpetuated.
Here is that mother that you talked about, Ronnie Dean Burren, talking to Huffington Post.
It's history, and I don't want any part of history watered down. I don't want people to say, well, you know, when women didn't have the right to vote, it wasn't that bad. That's not true. I don't want people to say, you know, the Native Americans didn't have it too hard. It was hard, but it's not what happened. And so at the end of the day, it's like we have this sort of we have all of these different stains on our collective past in this country. And words like this and textbooks like this, they come in and they sort of erase that stain and they sort of make it lighter and lighter and lighter. And we look up in, you know, 50 years and it's like, oh, was the slave trade that bad? It was. And all of these other sort of alternative narratives to, you know, mainstream history, they were bad. And we can't let one thing slip by. We can't.
And it does. And this means, I mean, you look at the controversy now over Margaret Spellings, her appointment now as head of the university system. I mean, these appointments really matter because, you know, luckily Ronnie Dean Buren gets involved and we all pay attention. But otherwise, these are the people in charge. It matters who runs these systems.
I think one of the things that Natalie highlights also in terms of being involved with our kids and what's happening in these schools, we also have to work very hard to provide narratives for them outside of the classroom.
Absolutely.
You know, that you know, her son knew that something was wrong because he obviously had been introduced to real Black and real American history beforehand and know that this narrative is absolutely incorrect.
Right.
And so in that way, it's no different than what it was for us 50 years ago, you know, before segregation, right? You know, or during segregation, you know, when we had to be very vigilant in terms of creating narratives for our children to understand who they are, why they are in the world, and why conditions are the way they are.
That's right. Yeah.
And, you know, and it gets back to, if you think about some of the debates, I think we're going to talk in a minute about naming and, you know, sort of, quote, ghetto names. We're going to get into that whole controversy in a minute. But the idea that you would be a society over and against, this brings us back to Black nationalism and the importance of this movement that was so widely excoriated, especially in white communities, the need to figure out what the truth is, because if you're not going to tell your own story, we know they're not going to tell it.
That's right.
So there is a need for a kind of a separatism in order to get the story straight. And then you can go back in contention if you want to have this, you know, great, great big assimilated family that we're all hoping for someday.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about that, the naming controversy, the name game. We've just got about a minute and a half left, and maybe that's all it's worth. I mean, the idea that that somehow – and let's – Mark, summarize this one for us, will you?
No, so Raven Simone, who is a young woman in her 20s that we all know from The Cosby Show, so ironically.
Yes.
You know, had some very interesting opinions about the names that Black folks give their children. There are a couple of things that are problematic about this. We can start with the fact that her name is Raven Simone.
You know, hyphenated.
So
right.
You know, so
the accent.
What is that?
So her parents gave her one of those names, right, that she's complaining about.
Right.
But this is the other thing, right? You know, we've gotten to a point in this culture that we have assigned importance to middling figures, you know, whose opinions now take up so much more space than they deserve in the culture. So whether it's Raven Simone or Charles Barkley or Don Lemon, you know, there's a narrative that might want us to pay attention to it, but we don't have to pay attention to this stuff. But the naming piece is important, right? Because the only thing that Black folks ever had were their names, right? And that meant that you don't call me out of my name.
That's right.
Right? That I'm going to push you to call me Mr. or Mrs. or Miss. Right. And I'm also going to have the right to name my child what I'm naming. So that child will have a connection to the culture, because part of the genocide, right, that's occurring is not just that you're killing us, you're killing our culture. And language and naming is what helps connect us to that culture.
Right. And I just want to say that even, you know, if you're going to name your child after a champagne or a car or anything like that, you know, on the surface, it may seem ridiculous, but I realize, and I'm grateful for friends who I've had the chance to talk about this with, who remind me, you know what, this is the only control that some of us have over, this is the only control we have over anything related to our lives. So let me name my child Moet. Right. Let me do that. Right. Let me name them Mercedes. But you don't have anything to say about it because you don't know anything about my life. You don't understand the ways that I'm oppressed on all sides. This is a way that I can exert some agency.
My mother gave me a very traditional name, Mark Anthony Neal, but she was also very conscious of what those first letters would spell out, right? That it spelled out man, and she wanted to make sure I knew, right, to always see myself as a man. And that was the kind of control that she was trying to have over my naming and how I saw myself in the world.
Awesome. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will give you a glimpse of man's appearance on the very normally named Mary Jane show. Call Me Mary Jane. Coming up on The State of Things, that and much, much more on Culture 360. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. We're continuing with Radio and Culture 360 today on the radio, examining Black identity, culture, politics, and pop culture, talking to our two regular contributors, Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. So we broke, Mark, you were talking about sort of how we highlight kind of middling figures and make them celebrities. And in some ways, the kind of celebrity status and how the media handles all this is the centerpiece of a television show on BET called Being Mary Jane, filtering news in a very interesting way. Show kicked off its third season this month. Natalie, tell us more about Being Mary Jane.
Well, it's the brainchild of Mara Brock Akil and her husband. Well, it's her brainchild, but her husband shares executive producer credits, I believe, with her and is usually the director, and she writes the show, and she's the showrunner as well.
Showrunner, yeah. Although she's leaving after this season.
Yes, yeah. But being Mary Jane is a young woman who is a talk show host, and basically she mixes news and issues, and I think it's been a very effective vehicle for discussing and bringing to bear issues of that Black women experience and deal with that really don't get discussed, in mainstream media. So, for instance, the most recent episode dealt with bipolar disease and suicide. Depression. There was a lot of heavy lifting that was going on in that particular episode. And I think that over the past 2 years that the show has been in existence, it has done some amazing work in addressing issues that are specific to Black women, but also depicting us in all of our variety in mm-hmm. ways that bring mm-hmm. humanity to us that I think is very nuanced and is also just so important because we really don't have, even with Shonda Land and all the things that Shonda Rhimes is doing, we really don't have a lot of opportunities to see ourselves on the big or small screen.
And you actually went to college with Mara, didn't you?
I did.
So you got,
I did.
Got a sense of how she, sort of what her vision was as a producer and a writer.
Well, it's interesting because Mara was a journalism major in undergrad. And then I remember at some point pretty soon after we graduated, and she's a year behind me at Northwestern, but she decided that she wanted to, I think she always wanted to write. And she figured out a way to work her way into the industry. I mean, she started off, I think she did a bit part, like she was acting at first, and then made her way into the industry, was able to make some connections, and very quickly was able to create girlfriends, and then went on to do The Game on BET. And I mean, she really has shown herself to be quite savvy in the way she has negotiated the space that she and Salim have carved out for themselves. And I'm so proud of her, for what that's worth. But I'm really grateful for her presence in the culture because, again, I think that she's doing some important work that right. we would not be seeing.
Mark, this point that Natalie makes about presenting more nuance for African-American presence and females as terms of characters, I think argues for, does it not, more creative control. It's not just about writing parts for African-Americans. It's making sure that that creative control over these projects are much more diverse than we have today.
Absolutely. Natalie and I were talking earlier, before we came on the air, what you get from ours, the fact that she loves Black people, that she loves Black women. And it comes out in writing. And I don't like going out of my way necessarily to give BET any credit here. but give them credit, right? This is a show that in many ways could only have appeared on a Black network.
That's right.
That would give her the kind of creative control. She had such success with The Game that they allowed her, to be able to do what she does in terms of drama. And when all is said and done, when BET looks back at its legacy, this might be the most important contribution that it's made,
Absolutely.
To televisional culture.
Yeah.
And maybe you're just saying that, Mark, because you've taken a paycheck from BET and, in fact, appeared on an episode of Being Mary Jane. We're going to play that clip right here. Here we go.
You know, there's usually an entry point for discussion like the one I hope to have today. A news item, a documentary, a book, or a radical act that allows us to take a deeper dive into a topic like Black women's beauty. I missed my window on this subject when Psychology Today published an article that brought into question Black women's beauty.
They didn't say that we were not beautiful. They said we were straight up ugly.
They did. Psychologist Satoshi Kanazawa actually tried to prove scientifically that we were less attractive. Mm. See, I just knew that this story was going to be all over the news, but what happened next is what astonished me more. The story came and went. I mean, sure, some Black women bloggers wrote eloquent, angry essays, and me and you, we tweeted about it, Michaela, but that was about it. The article was taken down, but no one rattled the cages for Black women except Black women. So maybe Satoshi was an entry point to the deeper issues I was looking for.
Uh-oh, Mary Jane, where are you going with this?
Hold on to your hats. I mean, forget if we're ugly or not. Maybe it's worse. Maybe Black women are invisible to our own men, or even worse than that, Black women are just not worth fighting for. Mark, does an attack like this do more damage to Black women than the silence of Black men?
If we're going to be honest, we've been dealing with 200 years of these kinds of attacks, right? So this is not anything new or unusual. What I think is really what's really egging Black women on at this period in time is this feeling of betrayal, that Black men did not close ranks around them, right? That Black male silence was complicit in the attacks that came from this particular magazine. Black women historically have always closed ranks around Black male issues. Black women should expect the same kind of support from Black men.
Mark Anthony Neal on Public Radio, no. On Left of Black, no. On Being Mary Jane on BET. So let me ask you this. Was that scripted? Because that is vintage Neal.
No, it was not scripted. You know, Mara told us and you know, they called us in and we had a conversation. And it was myself, Michaela Angela Davis, who's a great activist, image activist in New York City, and the artist India Ari. And they really wanted the conversation to be natural, right? As if we were having a panel discussion about these issues. We did about 14 takes, you know, over the course of 4 hours. But I think they wanted it to be organic. And I very much think that that was the conversation that came out of it.
Yeah, and think about the number of levels here involved. First of all, we talked earlier about the kind of these trivial sorts of conversations. I mean, here's this scholar at the London School of Economics who occasionally gets attention for this wacko science that he writes about. But again, we sort of have to pay attention to it. So that's one thing that's embedded in this program. And then the idea of this blend of fiction and reality as a way of kind of telling the real story in ways that real media, in terms of journalism media, is not. I mean, that's and a more nuanced story, Natalie.
Absolutely, and I remember watching this particular episode that Mark appeared in, and thinking, you know, just wanting to stand up and applaud because, first of all, you know, I'm working on a film about Black female beauty, but on top of that. As was said, you know, in the show, nobody's talking about it. Nobody's saying anything. And I had come across that very same report or study that the psychologist did. And it was interesting to me to, you know, think about, where are the Black male voices that, you know, you would hope would come to our defense and say, are you crazy? Black women are some of the most beautiful women on the face of the earth. Nothing. Crickets. And so it was very interesting, you know, to have this discussion being played out in this show, you know, but on top of that, to have these amazing culture critics, you know, that I'm familiar with and whom I respect, talking about this and really illuminating why this is going on, why no one is talking about it, and why it's important.
Is it effective, do you think, Mark? Is it more effective? Because this is a straight-up drama. I mean, in many ways, this is not some sort of didactic, every show we're going to get a speech in there. There's a lot of love and drama and all the things.
To be quite honest, if I think about the responses on social media, I think it was very effective. And I think that's one of the ways that you have to be able to tell these stories. Like, folks aren't going to watch documentaries, like at least not the folks that we want to watch documentaries. Right. You know, so if you can be able to find a way to tell these stories within scriptive narratives, I mean, she's even done the same around issues of homophobia, you know, on The Game, which is a half-hour comedy, but she was able to do scripts that actually address the idea of what it means to have a gay teammate and deal with issues of homophobia to traffic in the Black community.
I just to kind of cycle back to our show last month where we talked about diversity. You know, I think the fact that someone like Mara is on the scene, the way she is writing these scripts, and then the ways that the vision for the direction, the, you know, what we see in the shots and the way we see the rack focus and the ways that these characters and the issues are illuminated is so beautiful. I mean, just from a like cinematic perspective, it says to me, you know, that people are missing out. There are so many talented writers and directors and, art directors and editors right. that are of color that are not being given opportunities, but could bring so much vibrancy to the stories that are being told. And certainly the stories of people of color, you know, we are humans. So there are mm-hmm. universal, issues that come up in our stories that apply to everyone.
Yeah, and I don't have I'm going to ask the staff to check on this right quick because she's leaving as showrunner for that show, lest you think that okay, this is effective, but it's on BET, so she's speaking to communities of color. The attention she's gotten because of the success of that show has brought her to the attention of another network. I think it's going to be Warner Brothers, but I do want to check. She's leaving as showrunner because she's writing now a network program for what will have probably a wider viewership. So it's had that effect as well. Mark, we don't have a heck of a lot of time left, but I do want to switch gears and talk sports. World Series underway right now, and there's something missing in the field.
So I'm a lifelong New York Mets fan, so I'm deep into this series in ways that I wasn't before. And, you know, baseball for me was its relationship between my father. You know, my father introducing me to Willie Mays playing very late in his career for the New York Mets. So much of our relationship was about sitting down on Sunday mornings and watching Tom Seaver pitch for the New York Mets. You know, when you look at the sport now and you look on the field, there are a lot of Latino players, but very few players that might be identified as African-American men. I think center fielder Kane for the Kansas City Royals is, I believe, is African-American. Curtis Granderson came from Chicago for the New York Mets, went to UIC. And it's strange because, you know, 40 years ago when I first started watching this sport, you know, almost a third of the league were African-American. Though that was a time when they actually included African black ball players with Latino ball players. So Roberto Clemente would have been counted as a black ball player. When I see the sport now, I don't see black ball players playing Major League Baseball. Increasingly, we hear stories of HBCUs that will have teams in which the majority of the players are, in fact, Latino or white players. Mm-hmm. We don't see black kids on the sandlot. So someone like Monet Davis becomes a big story because it's a black ball player, right, dominating in terms of little leagues.
And a girl.
What do you think is happening?
I think part of it is that, you know, it's a sport that, first of all, needs a certain level of adult supervision. You know, you can go out and play pickup basketball. You can play even 3-on-3 touch football. You know, to play baseball, you need 18 men, you know, 18 players, girls and boys now increasingly. Yeah. Right. And usually you need some sort of adult that's there to be able to organize that. But also, you know, baseball loses out. You know, in comparison to sports like football and basketball, they've done a much better job marketing itself, much more exciting sport. You know, the thing with my father and I were the intricacies of the ball, right? A hit and run play, when to bunt, you know, a pitcher who could paint the corners. Those were the things that excited, right? Because it was a cerebral exchange with, you know, my father and I in that regard.
Well, are you saying, though, that there's something going on in black communities, that there's not enough adult supervision?
So Bill Stephanie, for instance, who was a promoter way back in the day for Public Enemy, he makes the argument that he thinks that baseball began to disappear in black communities as we start to see the erosion of black fatherhood in black communities, right? That if you didn't have black fathers there introducing their sons to the sport or other boys to the sport, you know, you wouldn't have that presence, right? But there, of course, are so many narratives of even mothers, you know, black mothers who found baseball so important that they were watching, you know, black baseball with their sons. So I think there's some validity to that, but I think there's also much more at play.
Mara is leaving to go to Warner Brothers, by the way. I was right about that. We did check on that. Now I've got about a minute and a half left, but I want to talk about Kendrick Lamar and his performance at the Kennedy Center, but also sort of being framed, in this way. It's on Ellen's show, for instance, as a kind of a role model. Let's listen to this. See what we're talking about here.
What does that mean when you're honored as a positive icon? What does that mean to you?
It means everything to me because I know it's a lot of kids in my neighborhood that's watching TV and saying, you know what, I want to be a positive influence, just like Kendrick Lamar or whoever's out there doing something for the good of the culture and for music. So it's everything.
Yeah, it really is amazing that you are from Compton, right?
Yeah, definitely.
From Compton. And you are so inspirational to so many people everywhere, but especially there, like you said, that it is positive. It's possible and more than possible to get out in a very safe, sober way.
Yeah, definitely. I blame that for my parents, you know. Yeah. They put something in my heart to do something more than what I was raised around and taking, you know, all my influence, whether negative or positive, and doing it in the right way.
I've only got about 30 seconds left, but this idea, Natalie, that, you know, sort of there's somebody that the white world will embrace as the role model.
Yeah, I mean, I love Kendrick Lamar, and that Ellen interview is really troubling to me, because I think that, you know, she's talking about positive in a very coded way. Yeah. And I think Kendrick, you know, he's sincere. He was trying to do something. Clearly, if you listen to Pimp a Butterfly, you hear what he's trying to do. And he does it very well, I think, with much brilliance. But, this idea of... It feels like, you know, he's been tapped. He's been tapped as that exceptional Negro who has, you know, because he's done things in a certain way, he got out of the hood. Mm-hmm. You know, she even says you can get out and, you know, and do things in a sober way. I just think that's so problematic, the way that she describes him. Even though I know her intentions were good, but I think that there's this, you know, doublespeak that doesn't really get addressed. Yeah. And then it in many ways, it minimizes the impact and power and importance of these artists.
Of a man whose music has become the anthem of Black Lives Matter.
Yeah, the Ta-Nehisi Coates of hip-hop.
I mean,
that's what it feels like.
We are out of time, and I'm so sad to say that. Natalie Bullock Brown, Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie, Emmy nominated. I'm trying to do the contraction to speed it up, and it's really slowing me down. Emmy nominated producer and filmmaker, teaches at St. Augs. Mark Anthony Neal teaches at Duke. He is the author of the book New Black Man, among others. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.